Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and I'm joined tonight by Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
And Perry Seibert. Say hello.
You have a beautiful spirit. Thank you for sharing your time with me.
Yes. Well, tonight's episode is about Atlanta, the comedy, drama, well, whatever it was fucking brilliant. A work of Afro-surrealism that's been compared to Twin Peaks from the mind of, from the mind of Donald Glover, with, of course, assistance by his brother Stephen and a director who, with his work on this series, has become one of my favorite working directors, Hiro Murai. It concerns four friends and family in Atlanta, two of which are cousins, one of whom is a rapper, the other one is his college dropout who now wants to be his manager. This dropout, Earn, was a dropout from an Ivy League school. For a very weird reason, as we eventually find out, he has an ex-girlfriend, a daughter he rarely gets to see, and they all have a very, very unusual friend. Now, if that sounds like a setup for an African-American version of Seinfeld, you are both right and absolutely wrong. This show is unlike anything I've ever seen. It's also one of my top 100 shows of all time, but we'll get into that later. So I will begin the way I always begin, and that is, Aaron, how did you first come to Atlanta?
Season 2 was about halfway done. I was aware of it. It's Donald Glover, and how do I put this? He's the king of us millennials. Donald Glover is our king, and we follow him where he leads. So I was very aware of the show. I don't have FX, so I didn't watch it. And I had gone back to school to get my teaching certificate at Buffalo State, and a friend of mine is like, have you seen Twin Peaks? Have you seen Atlanta? So that tips my hand. I said, no, but I want to. And they said, have you seen Twin Peaks? And I said, yes. And they said, it's the hip-hop Twin Peaks. I was like, I will find it any way I can. And we'll get into that later, but I do not feel like I was sold a bill of goods with that description.
No. Now, for me, I was aware of it because I kept hearing about it. By the time it started, I'd finally seen Community. And it was one of those shows that I did not get to watch it while the first season was airing. However, it got nominated for a shit ton of Emmys right after its first season. And I said, ooh, cool, I'm going to go and I'm going to catch up on this. And that's exactly what I did. I watched the first season, and eventually, season 2 came out a little delayed, and then we'll get into season 3 and 4 and how delayed they were. But I basically watched it close to live, at least, seasons 2, 3, and 4 I saw as they came out. But what about you, Perry? How did you get to the show?
I remember it premiering and was like, I want to see this. Donald Glover's brilliant, and
yeah.
I want to see this. And I just didn't. I couldn't be bothered with whatever was going on in my life at the time. I don't know, but I didn't start recording it. And then it was like, well, then I don't want to see it. I'll get to it. And then I remember that fantastic New Yorker profile that they did. If you've never read that, go check that out. And then there was the second season. I knew the second season was there, and the same thing was like, I hadn't seen the first yet. And then I can't remember when I finally picked up my Hulu subscription, if it was like late last year or near the beginning of this year, and Atlanta was the first thing I sat down and went through. I was so excited to finally see it. Burned through those first two seasons really quickly and then got to watch 3 and 4 in real time this year, and it has been a joy.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, the thing is we've all mentioned 3 and 4 a little bit here, and for those not in the know, COVID fucked things up. In addition to Donald Glover having to be convinced to do more Atlanta, he didn't initially want to do more Atlanta. He thought he'd do one, maybe two seasons, and that would be it. And then he finally was like, okay, screw it. I'm going to write all this during lockdown. This is going to be it. So it was all ready to go. Similar to what happened, I guess, with seasons 3 and 4 of Barry. And, yeah, they shot those basically back-to-back, and, you know, it was only, what, maybe 4 months between seasons, between season 3 ending and season 4 beginning, so it was pretty much a regular break, and yet, you know, that means that season 3 got skunked at the Emmys, and season 4, let's hope it doesn't. Lots of people love season 3, myself included, but I can also see why, with some of the risks it took, that it did get overlooked. Let's hope that the equally risky, and I mean, and by that I mean bold, season 4 doesn't get similarly forgotten come Emmy time, but we'll see. So moving on from that, I will go to you, Perry. What do you think the main theme of this series is?
I don't know if there's a main theme other than to say this is, you know, I don't want to call it a theme. This is the most like sort of fantastic pop culture look at what it is to be black in 21st century America, right? I mean, I don't know any other way to say this. It's just, that's what it is every week. It's not just that. It's not preachy, but that's what it is. I don't think there's an episode that doesn't answer that question. And
it makes no apologies.
And no, and it doesn't make a big deal about it either. It just is.
No.
It
points out the things that sometimes people are embarrassed about, and yeah, it's wonderful.
It's fantastic.
So other than using, you know, a single word, fantastic, how is it fantastic? In what ways does it achieve this fantastic level of quality?
Because it tackles this topic in every conceivable way imaginable. Like, it deals with it I don't even say straight up sitcom format, in a familiar 30-minute package when it wants to do that. It does it with incredible flights of fantasy and surrealism. It does it with affectionate humor, and it does it with really bitter humor. They cover every single possible emotional and stylistic tone over the course of these, what, 41 episodes? Is that what it is?
Okay. Yeah, 41.
It is. Even if it weren't, here's where I'll land on this. it is so fantastic because it would be important if it were just this wonderful sort of piece of artistic reportage of what this is like, and it would also be fantastic if it were just this brilliant stylistically. It happens to be both, and they're wedded. it's a work of art. And I don't say that about television ever. it's really great.
Oh, it's one of the all-time great shows. So, Aaron, you?
One of the things I said, I have said a lot since 2016, which happens to be the year that this premiered, was that in today's political climate, that political satire is dead. And so to do what satire used to do, you have to expand. You have to expand out. The great political films now are science fiction films or surrealist films. Not just films, but, you know, books, television shows. And this has an inherent understanding of that. When you could write this off as a satire, but it's not satirizing. It's flipping everything on its head. And yes, at its core, it is a show that says it's a show that understands that it has two audiences. It's a show that says to its white audience, this is how you can begin to understand the experience of Black Americans. Meanwhile, to its Black audience, it's kind of hammering home the issues within the community, all while not alienating the white audience that it's equally hammering at, just for watching at all. It welcomes us to the show while also hammering us for watching it. It's really profound what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I can think of two instances that handle both of what you just said, and they're in season four. The Vanessa-focused episode that's basically a critique of the Tyler Perry phenomenon, and the very simple B story of Earn's father in the one episode, which is a great episode because the whole episode gets into a lot of issues of African-American culture, including you know, issues about, you know, coloration. Although in the case of Earn's aunt, it's not that she's light. It's just she's a crazy fucking mean bitch. And that's to quote her own family, who says it's not because you're white, you're almost white girl. It's because you're a crazy mean fucking bitch. But Earn's father just wanting to spend time alone, and his son asks him for help, and he says, boy, I've dealt with this craziness in that family for over 30 years. You can deal with it for a few hours on one Sunday. So, you know, it's wonderful. I mean, you know, there's just so much in this show that we can point to. I mean, we could do a whole series of shows and really break this show down. But, you know, I don't know if we really have the time to get through that. That would be a whole different show. So now I'm going to get back to you, Aaron. Do you have a least favorite episode? An episode that, you know, of all the episodes, maybe works the least for you?
I have been, this is honestly the one question that I've been hung up on. I know that they're not all tens. It's not a show that has 41 10-star episodes. But at the same time, I can't think of one that I would say just on its own merit is a lesser episode either. I don't, you know what? Towards the end of season two, and this is still a great episode, but there's this episode where they go on a mini tour of Georgia and end up at this white bread college party. And it's hilarious, but it doesn't, it's not a home run. And that's the worst thing I can say about the show. It's hilarious, but it's not a home run. As the three male principals of the show, Earn, Al, and Darius, are sitting bored on a couch in front of a gigantic Confederate flag.
There's some really good stuff there, but it's very sitcom-y compared to the rest of the show.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I put this question in there to kind of elicit that sort of a response. But what about you, Perry? Which episode of all the episodes worked the least for you? You know, which was your least favorite?
Yes, that's what I'm afraid. It's my least favorite. I don't dislike it. I don't dislike it at all because I think it accomplishes a whole lot. But after going through all of it, it's the very first episode because I feel like that is the only one that is close to conventional. And I understand why. I understand that's where you're going to jump from. But, I mean, visually,
your Trojan horse.
Visually, it's fantastic. I mean, it is what the series was going to be. But thematically, they don't take nearly as big a swing as they're going to in the very next episode. So that's always like, yes, exactly. It's the Trojan horse to get in. And so that's why, that's the one that to me, yes, there are probably episodes I can think of that I like less than that one. But even if I like them less, it's, you know, no one else has done what this show has done. And so
yeah.
I'm willing to that will score a lot of points for me for commercial television. Yeah.
And can we just say that, yeah, you know, you've got this somewhat conventional pilot. I still think it's a great one, especially visually. So,
absolutely.
You know, both these are great ones, and I was really going to pick one of these two, so I'll just co-sign on both. But, you know, that second episode, we have Alfred, who is Earn's cousin, and Al is the one that wants to be a rapper, a successful rapper. He's already a rapper, and he's got some success, but not enough yet. And what happens? He gets robbed by his drug dealer. So he's like, man, that motherfucker robbed me. I got to go get a new one. I got to get a new connection. So he goes through several very irritating dealers who they want his autograph. They want to be his exclusive dealer. They want to sign a contract. They want him to get all of his rap friends to do it because he's just starting to get big. And he's like, man, to Earn, he says, man, this fame shit may not be what it's cut out to be. And you're just sitting there going, oh, my fucking God, this thing is 10,000 types of brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
It really is.
And then you get to the extended portion of Earn waiting to get be bailed out, which is stunning. I mean, that's when I was like, this show knows exactly what it wants to do, and it's doing it already.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now, Aaron, you know, this show sometimes gets compared to Twin Peaks, but I think that's a misunderstanding of what Afro-surrealism is. So how does this both differentiate and line up with Twin Peaks, and how would you describe Afro-surrealism?
Well, Afro-surrealism is an academic term that basically implies what I said with the thematic question, which is that surrealism is the only way to truly explore the African-American experience. I would say, perhaps generously, but I would say it anyway, that this is the flip side of the Twin Peaks coin. I would say that what differentiates it is what also makes it Twin Peaks. Twin Peaks is suburban rural. This is urban. Twin Peaks is white bread. This is black. And David Lynch's great theme throughout his work is kind of the absurd and seedy underbelly of white bread America. And Donald Glover's theme throughout this is how freaking weird it is to be a black person in a nation that is controlled by white supremacy at every turn. And how do you deal with your inherent otherness? And so while Twin Peaks is using the surrealism to get at the pure evil that's inside of all of us, Atlanta is using the surrealism to explore being the other in kind of a monolithic society. And it's monolithic not because of actual demographics, it's monolithic because of design. And how do you navigate that? So I would say, like, again, to come back, that what makes them different is also what makes them the same, ultimately. And it's the way that they're using surrealism to explore their themes.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about you, Perry?
It is accurate, and it doesn't help explain the show at all, right? Mm-hmm. I'm saying basically the same thing. Because, and I think what it comes down to is let's just drop the Afro for the moment. Because let's just talk about it's a work of surrealism. And I can name, like, what, 5 shows in the history of TV that I would actually call surrealist shows. Maybe 6. Okay? it's not a device television tends to go to, because it's alienating, and that's not what television does. So it's easy to go to Twin Peaks, because Twin Peaks is the grand shining example of an actual surrealist artist doing that. You know, this is not that far removed from St. Elsewhere. You know, as far as
to
handle these tones and to go off in places that we just accept as weird, and that's okay in this fictional universe.
You know, you just made me think about something, and I want to latch onto that before I forget about it. You mentioned Twin Peaks, you mentioned St. Elsewhere. I brought up Twin Peaks. But, you know, it occurs to me that Atlanta has elements, just because of some of the weird shit that happens in it, almost, not quite, but almost the same type of magical realism that hung around the edges of both St. Elsewhere and Northern Exposure.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And that's utterly... yes. And I think Glover's a savvy enough, you know, purveyor of the history of entertainment to know that. And where this... And really where Atlanta... Where I think it makes its great advancement as far as any surrealism on TV is it actually, especially after the second season, completely unmoors being a soap opera. Like, it's not about what's going to happen next with these characters. It's not, you know, it doesn't have to latch on to any conventional television narrative at all during season 3 and 4. I mean,
these last 20 episodes were just like Glover and his crew exploring and saying everything they wanted to say.
And even before that, it was already well sort of, you know, unhinged from it. I mean, season 2 is the one that's closest to being an actual, you know, beginning to end movie that you could watch for 6.5 hours. But you don't need to. And I'm not watching it because, oh, I want to see if Paperboy makes it. Oh, I'm just hanging out with these people.
At the end of season 2, they throw FUBU at us.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the best part is Glover knows this. And has, you know, and not hint at it, just outright pointed out at different points in the show, he's a savvy enough, you know, understander of what entertainment is and what culture is, that he's willing to point out, yeah, this is this, and we could do this, but we're not really doing this. This is something else.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
all part of the brilliance of this show.
You know, this gets, and I want to continue on this, so I'm going to ask this. What influences do you think this show has had, other than the ones we've already talked about, Perry?
Influences it had?
Influences on the show. Which shows influenced this show, other than the ones we already mentioned?
Aside from the ones we've already mentioned? I would say
not just other shows, but what were the general influences, like in art, history, whatever?
I will give you a television sensibility that I understand why he is never mentioned, but I'm going to talk about one of my favorite people in television for the last 30 years. Paul Sims is a producer on this show, and he's not like the household name like so many TV people. But Paul Sims is responsible for, or was a major contributor to, news radio. He wrote for David Letterman, Larry Sanders' show. He's currently working on Things We Do in the Dark, Flight of the Conchords, Girls, or What We Do in the Shadows, I mean, Girls. This is one of the great comedy television writers of all time. And one of arguably the very best of the last 30 years. You know, that goes to show how smart Glover is to have these very talented people around him at very high levels. So I like to think that that the references that come to bear on the show in its creation are from this incredible, this team that from the top down knew what they could do, had people around them to support them doing it, both, and for that, full credit to FX. Seriously, what network would put this on and let it go and give them that much freedom? Fantastic. Good on you, FX. Yes, I'm going to plug the Suits. They did a good job with this one.
Yeah, and let's not forget that probably the best episode of season one, the seventh episode, Home, of the first season of Boardwalk Empire, was co-written by Sims.
Yes, by Sims, yep. So I don't have a good answer for you, because I think it's such a fan. He doesn't want to pay tribute to anything. And then my cheesy one sentence answer to your question is, if you're asking me what, the, you know, in all of art, what it is, it's the greatest hip-hop television series ever. And this coming from someone who's not drawn to hip-hop. And never was. I'm a boomer friendly Gen Xer. I can't help it. I'm a rock guy. I knew it from the beginning. I understand it's not for me, and that's okay. I don't have any ill will. I'm not drawn to it whatsoever. But the closest thing to it, and I don't know, I'm off on the time because I can't remember when this came out. When did Sorry to Bother You? That's the title, right?
Boots.
Like that's the closest thing I can see to it, right? And
which
it's
is another
so much better
work
than
of
that, and that's a good movie. Exactly. And so obviously, and I don't know when that came out compared to the first season of Atlanta. I don't know if it predated it or they were about the same time or what.
I think it was between the first and second season.
So that's, you know,
because there, it was there, enough there, that Lakeith Stanfield could carry it.
That's right. Yeah, very true. Very true. So there's a lot of answers that I think are kind of about what you asked.
Okay. Well, what about you, Aaron?
So obviously coming from Community, I don't think Dan Harmon's influence on Donald Glover personally could be understated.
And Donald Glover's actually talked about
Dan
Harmon being a really good person to have worked with and to help and that quote, Dan helped me become a better writer.
Yeah, hey, Tina Fey, he worked with Tina Fey too, and mm-hmm. on the writing staff of 30 Rock, won a WGA with her. So the influence of that Thursday night NBC block back in the late aughts is undeniable on this show. Moving forward, since we keep, you know, flirting with season three but not really touching it, season three belongs to two people, Louis Bunuel and Rod Serling.
Mm-hmm.
It is a weird, weird combination of European surrealism, which is distinctly different from American surrealism,
yeah.
and of Twilight Zone. And I know what you're thinking. That sounds insane, and it is. And
yet it
I'm
fucking
here
works.
For every second of it.
Well, you know, the thing is, my wife and I sat down and watched the first episode of Atlanta season three, and we turned to each other and said, you know, this show's always had these vibes, but damn, if that wasn't almost straight horror. And seasons three and four of Atlanta really lean into a horror.
They do.
In the best sense of the word, the way that horror really, great horror, digs into deeper
issues.
It's
nightmare logic. It's diving
mm-hmm.
even more into the surrealism and specifically the dark side of it.
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that you mentioned Bunuel and Serling because that's what they were working in as well.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we've already mentioned Lynch, and I think that season four especially, if that's the way that people, if Twin Peaks was how you were selling it in season one and two, then, Blue Velvet and Lost Highway are maybe how you could sell season four.
Well, and the straight story.
It's a deep dive. What's that?
Yep.
And the straight story for how we wrap up Paperboy.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Although, you know, here's something that you may find, and not a lot of people are going to agree with me, but there are elements in this of Frank's Place, in that it so deftly blends comedy and drama. It's also about the African-American community, and it does so much. Unfortunately, Frank's Place gets forgotten now. Because of the music they had in the show, they cannot get the music rights sorted out, so we're probably never going to see it on DVD, which is a really damn shame. But, yeah, I have to say that I think there are parts of this show that owe some of the structure to Frank's Place. If either of you have seen that, I don't know if either of you have. Have you, Perry or Aaron, either of you?
I saw episodes of Frank's Place when it originally aired.
So do you know what I'm talking about then, or do you have dim memories?
I mean, they're not sharp, but yes, I don't think that that's an outrageous statement.
Yeah. And there's also a show in the way that, and it's another show centered around another show about African Americans largely, and that's a show that was on Showtime called Lynx. Did either of you see Lynx?
I did not.
No.
Yep, that was about a black Republican who owned a bar, who had a conservative strategist as a friend, a conservative congressman, I believe he was, maybe a senator. It's been a while since I've seen the show, that was a patron at his bar. And he had a very liberal daughter and a very liberal waitress and a girlfriend played by Pam Grier, who was definitely not the same persuasion as he was. It is a great show, and I also think that that has some influence as well. It's also from some of the same people that did Frank's Place, and it has a similar look as as Atlanta does, where it tackles social issues and political issues, where Atlanta does it both overtly and covertly. Lynx really did hit it because of where it was set. It was set in Washington, D.C. But I do think that these are two shows that just as I was thinking about this question over the last couple of days, I thought to myself, you know, which two shows, because let's try to keep it to TV for me, because I know everybody else is probably going to come up with movies and books and other things, but this is what I came up with. So I just, and if anyone out there wants to check those shows out, you can find episodes of them floating around. Unfortunately, it's really, really, really fucking difficult. I honestly had all of Lynx on VHS at one point. I recorded it off air when it first came on, and some of those tapes are now missing because my old VCR ate a couple of them. But somewhere at my mother's house is a box of VHS tapes with probably about two-thirds of Lynx, and I will treasure those forever if I can ever find another VHS player. So moving along, Perry, do you think this – oh, no, actually, I could ask you the question first. Aaron, do you think that this has had any influences yet? Do you think that since Atlanta has come out, that it's had any influence on television?
I think that most of the influence that you see Atlanta having at this point can also be drawn back to FX and kind of the hands-off approach that FX as a network has, and here we go praising the Suits again. but let's be honest, FX has been a game changer for Super Basic. When Glover brought the pilot to FX, they said, "Now you're going to get real weird with this, right?" And he said, "Yeah." They said, "Don't pull back," like. They were in from the get-go, and I don't think that, like, I am not in the habit of praising studios of any sort, but this one didn't mm-hmm. screw up, and I think that no. that's something that needs to be acknowledged. I think, though, obviously it's too soon to say how much influence it has had. But I do suspect that it will. I guess you could maybe argue that there was some influence on Issa Rae's Insecure. But that might just be... It might look like influence because they're two millennial black artists who put TV shows out at the same time, near the same time. So it might just be that they're having similar experiences. So it's still hard at this point to suss out what's influence and what's just commonality, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Harry?
I will sneak around the fact that it's way too early to know by saying any show that is going to establish Lakeith Stanfield, Ryan Tyree Henry as like two of the best actors alive. Yeah.
mm-hmm.
If it's just giving them careers for the next 40 years, that's influence enough.
Three careers.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it also does. Yeah, not to mention, obviously, Hiro Murai, who is suddenly fucking everywhere, and deservedly so.
Well, and Stephen Glover had not written anything before Atlanta, and he has his own show now, and So, yeah, there's, I mean, he definitely opened a lot of doors for a lot of people.
Hey, and that's awesome.
Sorry.
And, you know, I mean, if this show ends up being one of those things like, you know, the Rockford Files, that you look at what came from the Rockford Files, you look at the directors, producers, and writers that basically ruled TV from 1980 onwards and all got their start on Rockford Files, or at least their big break, hey, that's fine, right? Now maybe we'll trace the next 30, 40 years of TV back to Atlanta, and wouldn't that be wonderful?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because, you know, you look at some, I mean, some shows just become that influential. I mean, you know, Perry, you and I talked about it when we discussed St. Elsewhere. I mean, look at all the people that came off of that show, both on and off the camera.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's astounding. And that's something that I think television is almost uniquely, not only say qualified, but it's something that television does on a consistent basis, and it's almost unique to it, that it keeps creating these names, these figures that then fill our entertainment world. But, you know, it's the nature of the beast because of the repeated viewings, because you have to keep making more product. So I will ask you.
The audition process is faster. The turnaround is faster. More people are getting eyes on it. It's just easier to get exposed through television than it is through film.
Yeah, yeah. And now I'm going to ask this question, and that is, what is our favorite episode? Aaron?
Oh, man. It came to me. Well, I think that until very recently, I would have said that Teddy Perkins was my favorite episode. It's just so perfectly creepy and nonsensical. But man, oh man, oh man, oh man, were there some classics. But I am going to go with Work Ethic, the total takedown of the Tyler Perry empire. And
oh yeah, God
sorry.
Damn.
Snipe Hunt, which is about Ern and Van and their daughter going camping, was probably the most single touching episode of the entire show. They really showed a level of pathos that they really hadn't gone into. They were always very interested in finding different ways to make you laugh, different ways to make you think, different ways to make you uncomfortable. But there was never a huge emotional payoff until that one. And so that one stands out to just for what it is. Gosh, the last four episodes, though. They were perfect. I don't know what to say. I'm not going to list titles because I don't know whose thunder I'll be stealing, but the last four or five episodes were all amazing.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is I may still go with Teddy Perkins, but you know, I think Ban is great. I definitely also agree with you on your choice, but I also think the what was it, the Goof Who Sat on the Corner, the mockumentary in season four was, oh man. And you know, there are a lot of episodes in season three where I think they're amongst the greatest things I've ever seen on television, at least for part of the episode. Or there are episodes that are very good with one or two moments that elevate them, like the Liam Neeson scene in that one episode of in season three. There's just such great stuff here. But yeah, so for me, it may still be Teddy Perkins in some ways, but I'm honestly really, really going to go I'm tied with the three I mentioned, so, which is of course your choice as well. But you know, I do think that I don't want to get into this stuff because you're making me think about what we're gonna talk about next, and it's getting me excited about where we're gonna go with this in just a moment. But Perry, your favorite episode.
Okay, so I went through the episode list, like, real quick and just wrote down, like, what would I consider this episode to be possibly one of the very best? And I literally wrote down four episodes from season one, four episodes from season two, five from season three, and five from season four. So basically I'm saying half the show, you could throw a dart and you've got a 50-50 chance of hitting a show that might be the best show they ever did, okay? So I will limit myself the best I can and just try to mention only one from each season. Well, can I do that? Is that acceptable?
I'm going to
answer really personally.
As
I'm not going to answer
John
that.
Once said on an episode of Community, I'll allow it.
No, I'm going to answer my favorite. Not necessarily the ones I think are formally the best or the most challenging, but the ones that I think just worked for me. Or a point in the show where I went, wow, this is really surprising me in the best possible ways. So for me, from season one, and I love this episode, and I feel like nobody talks about it, Value. I love the first Van episode. I think it's really good. Of the more conventional episodes, for sure. I mean, it's a sitcom episode, granted with a very long discourse at the beginning about the value of black women in society that's brilliantly done. But that episode just paid off in just rich and wonderful ways for me. And I love that episode. Season two, boy, there are a lot to choose from. There are so many to choose from. But I'm gonna go with Helen. I love their fight over the ping pong game. I love the sheer weirdness of a German festival in the middle of this series. Love it. that one.
Yo, wait. You mean she's German? Yeah, all right.
Exactly. Season three again. You know, pound for pound, probably the strongest season of the bunch, in my humble opinion. And if I have to pick one, I'm going to pick Sinterklaas is Coming to Town. Because not only do I adore all the ridiculous stuff about Paperboy doing the show, but, just give me Lakeith Stanfield and Sassy Beats in this wonderful Europeanly surreal party that ends with one of the only times I've ever been genuinely shocked by a moment on television. I did not. Don't see that end coming. Just don't see it coming. And it's fabulous. And season four, I agree, work ethic. I sat there giggling the whole time that anybody in that position would spend a half hour to just TNT Tyler Perry. And
you are a Kirkwood chocolate woman, and I am impervious to your coffee. Oh, sir, can we get you any help? Of course, woman. I'm bleeding. I'm burned.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey,
fuck you.
That's satire. That's satire. Through and through, and I love the fact that he saves the sharpest satire to talk to his black audience, to use the demarcation we used before. I think was fascinating and so interesting, and it's so funny, And as someone who had to write about Tyler Perry films for a decade, it was so nice to see.
as someone who got stuck with someone, I was stuck somewhere for a couple of days, and they insisted on watching a Tyler Perry marathon. I have seen more Tyler Perry than I thought even existed. I think I might have lost several hundred brain cells. Well, sorry, maybe several million brain cells. I definitely developed a tic for a couple of hours afterwards. Yeah, that shit's fucking painful, man. It's god awful. Now that's not to say that, you know, I haven't seen Tyler Perry do some good stuff. I've seen him do some serious work as a dramatic actor, but you know, the Madea stuff, I know it has its audience and I know it gets respected, but that's the type of shit, and more, you know, these cookie cutter factory soap operas that he's been creating for, what is it, BET and I think TBS, is it? TBS? That's TBS, the stuff that Glover and company were knocking, and that shit
is,
I mean,
we're just framing.
Yeah.
And I do love that episode, and it's not the only time that season this last season that Donald Glover really does this. I love how much of this fourth season can be read that it's Donald Glover telling us what he doesn't want to become. The goof who sat by the door, like, you could see this very smart, like, okay, I understand the trap. This is what I cannot fall into. And that's, I love that. I just love that.
Yep. So Perry, I'm going to ask you this question. What do you think the show's greatest weakness is?
I will jujitsu this answer. The weakness is that it will never get the mass adulation it deserves.
That's fair enough.
The weakness is in the audience. It's not in the show. I really don't think it has. Again, it's not its weakest part. If we're going to pick one, it's its least strong part, right? I mean, there's nothing to pick at here. It's so perfectly conceived and so surprising that it, could I nitpick about one or two things? Yeah. Do I grow tired of the Paperboy episodes by the end of the series more than the others? Those get a little repetitive for me when we're just hanging out with Paperboy for the whole half hour. I still love them. I think they're hilarious.
Old McAlfred had a farm, E-I-E-O.
That joke is so good. That joke is so good. In the finale when they
sing
that.
Fuck you here and
yeah,
the fuck
like,
you there. Shut up, Burn, give me my bread.
So good.
You know, that little
penitent, you know,
that little thing, that was awesome at the end.
Oh, yeah. It's that's not a weakness. I'm picking the one thing I might say that I don't like as much as everything else on the show. There's no weakness here other than the inability of the mass public to flock to this thing and make sure it wins.
You know, if I was gonna say anything, it might be for me that I think that sometimes it didn't do as much as it might have, and this is me trying not to colonize another writer's work and tell them what they ought to have done. But this is just a preference for me. I think that they did so much work with so much else that I would have preferred. I'm not saying that when they did it, they didn't do a great job, because they did. But I think that if there's something they could have maybe done a little more of here and there, and again, I'm with you that it's not exactly a weakness. It's just, you know, maybe it's more audience-based. I think I would have liked to have seen them do a little bit more exploration of black womanhood and women in general. You know, more than just with Vanessa and occasionally one or two of her friends and the one episode we get with Earn's mean, crazy bitch aunt, as his one cousin calls him. And you know you still owe me $700, right? You mean crazy bitch? we saw that cousin for like 2 minutes total in like a 6 minute scene, maybe 90 seconds. And that became instantly one of my favorite characters. I want a spinoff. I want to see him talking on the phone, barbecuing for 20 minutes an episode. That's awesome. But,
The back door in that episode, I can't remember the artist. So-and-so had it made. Well, it didn't work for him. Well, maybe you'll have better luck. I am in 100% agreement with Perry. There's not a glaring weakness in this show. I think that they were smart to take the extra time with COVID to really get season 3 and 4 right, instead of rushing into it the second that lockdown was over and maybe having a less perfect product. I think that I don't know. Like, there's nothing I can point to that's like, no, that didn't work. Like, everything worked. It did what it's supposed to do. So, like, yes, there's things that maybe as a viewer I would have preferred, but at the same time, there's nothing. I say this a lot. Everything there is perfect. Now, there maybe could have been more. Maybe its biggest weakness is that, you know, they're not going to have a season 5. I don't know. But I also think that the way they had it was amazing. So,
yes,
there's no complaints from me.
Well, now you're going to like this next question then. Who's your favorite character?
Is that me?
Yep.
Me or Perry? Darius.
You, Aaron.
Darius.
And here I thought it was going to be the old white lady chasing him on a scooter.
Darius is a cartoon character in the middle of real life. Everything that happens to him,
cartoon, isn't it?
Is simultaneously 100% possible and 100% absurd. Not to mention, he is 100% responsible for the Florida Man meme. So God bless his soul. What can I say? Like, it's Darius. It's Darius.
What about you, Perry?
Darius. It's Darius. Mm. It's Darius from Day Till Night. That is, Keith Stanfield is doing, he's doing Buster Keaton. He's doing Buster Keaton. I can't give higher praise than that. He is the only, they wrote Darius so that he was the only character on this show touched with grace. he was beautiful inside and out. He just was. He's the only one who is not striving to be something else. He is the zen center of all of this. And that is such an amazing tonic to be.
Yeah, and he gets so many great moments, you know, like the like in season three where he finds the West African restaurant and then it gets taken over by white people. You know, the
one of my favorite episodes.
And then of course we have everything.
And he's responsible for it.
and that's what we're going to get to. Before I go into the last set of questions, we're going to go to a question that I didn't really pose, but we're going to dive into it. The meaning of that last episode, it's all a dream. And, you know, my wife and I, we watched it, and she said, oh, so it was all a dream. And her take, and I think she might have a point, is that it was all Darius coping with the loss of his father and creating friends to spend time with. What do you guys think? What is your interpretation of the final episode? Perry?
This is not a show, as we've established, that was locked in reality. So he gave you the open ending. Take it however you want. You know, we don't get to see if Judy's sick or not, so we get to decide. And so, I prefer my Judy
Thin. And I don't think
it
ultimately matters.
So, it doesn't, but I prefer my Judy Thin. So I like to think that this was all, this happened for the most part, but I don't care if you don't. And guess what? Darius doesn't either. And I'll always follow Darius. So I'm fine. Darius is happy. I'm happy.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Aaron?
I remember when I watched it, and I've told you this, but when I watched it, I thought, oh, so they took the Inception ending and actually did it with ambiguity.
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean,
we all know how Inception actually ended, but this one is truly ambiguous. And I guess I'm of the camp that, as soon as I saw that the final episode was called "It Was All a Dream," that I assumed that it meant literally the entire show, not just that episode, not just something else.
Right, exactly.
I have zero difficulty with her reading. I've not given it too much thought into my own reading because I am a postmodernist by trade, and I like to live with the ambiguity that's given to me.
Right.
I choose not to think that Judy was thin or thick. I choose to think that, you know, Judy stayed in Schrodinger's box.
And you prefer Schrodinger's cat to stay in the box because of your fondness for the feline form.
I prefer to live in a world of uncertainty, and I want to not know. But I think that there's plenty of evidence throughout the series, especially in seasons 3 and 4, that would imply that there is a lot that is not actually happening.
And can I just say that, you mentioned doing Inception right, and this is going to piss off a lot of the Nolan fanboys, but is it maybe because Donald Glover and Hiro Murai are a better writing-directing combo than Christopher and Jonathan Nolan?
They're better writers. For sure.
Well, they're definitely they're you know, the thing is Jonathan Nolan, I think, did wonderful work on Person of Interest, but you know, the work that Murai and Glover did together and separately on this is just on a whole different level. But
they
I could spend a whole hour.
The fact that Inception exists.
Right.
To be fair.
Yeah. But now I'm going to get back to the other questions, because you know, we had to get into that last episode and that final scene, and because that really goes into how the show really does play with reality consistently. You know, I read some reviews and people saying, well, it was great up until it wasn't. This show pulled reality out from under us, and I'm thinking to myself, so you haven't been watching it from the first scene?
Right.
Okay, I guess nobody was paying attention in your brain, writer. But yeah. So, Aaron, here's the next question. How do you rank the seasons?
Oh my God. Really?
Mm-hmm.
Jeez, man.
Oh, I know you can hate me for this one.
Aaron, you want to buy some time? You want me to answer first?
Oh no. He has
no,
to answer
do.
First. Oh no. I insist. I have a pattern of questions here, so you know.
Fair.
But we can always commit.
You know what?
4-3-2-1.
4-3-2-1.
You know,
every season
fair.
Got better.
I would actually probably put it 4 with 3 and 2 tied and then 1 myself. There are elements of 3 that I think are pretty much the best shit the show ever did, but the stuff that I didn't like in 3 puts it just below 4. And 2, while I think 2 might be, you know, the best season in some regards, it definitely doesn't take the chances that 3 and 4 did outside of Teddy Perkins. And 1 is a classic, but whew, what follows is phenomenal. So, Perry?
3-4-2-1. But again, they're all within.
Yeah, I mean, like I told Aaron, you know, they're all tens, but you know, it's like one is a slightly stronger ten than the other.
None
you
more
know?
Black.
Yes, none more black.
So now Perry, here's the question for you.
All right.
Where would you place this all time as a show?
It is one of the two greatest works of surrealism that's ever been on television, as we've firmly established.
Well played.
Yeah, can I give him that?
Yeah, you know, for me, it's in my top 100. I've currently got it at 79, but that's not where it's going to stay. I'm trying to figure out a way to get it into my top 50. I've got some stuff to move up and down to get it there. But you know, this is the nature of the way I work on things when I rank them. You know, things are always shifting, and just because I've seen something that I like more doesn't mean that the stuff that I now like less is suddenly of lesser value to me. It's just that I want to place this new love where I feel it belongs. So what about you, Aaron? Where do you have it all time?
24. Sandwiched between the two great lady comedies of all time, one of which we'll be discussing later. It's firmly number 24 all time. It is one of the great comedies of all time. It is, as Perry said, one of the great works of television surrealism of all time. It is the best thing to ever deal with the music industry of all time. wherever
That's
you want
good.
To put it, it's high. It's high.
Yeah, yeah. And now, Aaron, is this ultimately a triumph of writing, acting, directing, or production?
Yes.
Exactly, yeah.
No cheating.
Okay. So, the problem is, in this show in particular, and we've talked about a lot of shows lately that were strong on three of the four elements, and then, like, the other was kind of there. Like, this show, the production on this show is perfect. And that's not something that happens often. Now, I won't say it's the show with the best production in recent memory. But it's among them. The direction, especially when it's Glover or Mirai, is impeccable. I think that if those two had directed every single episode, it would have been directing, which is shocking in a television show. So here's where the real tangle comes in. The writing, which is perfect, or the cast, which is also perfect. The reason I have to go with writing, I guess, long story short, is that without the director and without the writer, the cast is, you know, on its own. Unless it's Downton Abbey, you don't have a cast of actors that are upgrading the writing, which somehow did happen in Downton Abbey. So I, once again, as always with television shows, have to go with the writing.
And Perry.
Here's how I'm going to get out of answering this straight. All four of these things, right? Writing, acting, directing, and directing. This show, as you said, beautifully, did all of them really well all of the time. And so I will say that, you know, if you think of them as levers on a mixing board, they all got up to 10 18 times for me. I listed off 18 of 41 episodes as being possibly my favorite show of a show that I've already said is one of the greatest shows ever on television. Now, yeah, I'm not answering this one this time. They're all fantastic because they all, with the best TV, it all feeds off each other. Once the writers see what the actors do and bring to it that they didn't expect, they start writing to what the actors can do. And so, and that just feeds off each other, especially on this show. Because you can tell me that this show would have worked with other actors. I don't know that I believe you. I really don't. And so I don't want to credit one over the other. And the same goes true for the production and the direction. Whatever, you know, it certainly wasn't directorial creativity that was limiting this show. So I'm assuming it had to have been the production budget was the only limit on what they could do, and it never felt limited. They went wherever they wanted to go. They shot whatever they wanted to shoot. So no, I can't answer this one on this. They're all superb.
No, you know, that's actually pretty fair, to be honest. I probably would side a little bit with Aaron on, you know, it being dead heat between writing and directing. But, you know, it's so hard to choose with this show because this is one of those shows that it does everything so damn well. You know, it sounds like we're just fawning over this show without, you know, bringing up anything that it did wrong. And, you know, but I think that the minor problems we have with this show ultimately don't really matter. And is the point of criticism and analysis to talk only about the flaws just to say, see, we can find something that we didn't like? I think it's more interesting to talk about what worked when 99% of a thing works. Why focus on the one thing that doesn't matter? It would be like seeing the most gorgeous painting you've ever seen in the best frame you've ever seen, except there's one little tiny nick in the bottom right-hand corner of that frame. So you're going to talk about that. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. So now we've come to the part of the show that I call housekeeping, and that is telling you what's coming up on Deviant Legion. And here at Deviant Legion, we are getting ready to do a few episodes. Rock This Town Radio with TC is going to be on the 20th. So on Sunday at 8 p.m., and that will be what he's calling Rockabilly Rampage. On the 21st, Vicky Love is coming back with her SF show and a new host. Then this show, Cathode Ray Mission, will return next Friday with a look at the works of director Ken Russell. 2 weeks after that, on the 9th of December, this show will be back again, this time with a look at the modern classic comedy series Fleabag. Dark comedy. Very dark.
Hey, you thought we found
a whole different
just
levels of
wait.
Fucked up. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I do have to say this. Yes, only 12 episodes. But what 12 episodes? So, please join us for these episodes, folks. Join us. And now back to our regularly scheduled programming. So, Perry, is there anything that we haven't gotten to yet before we get going that you would like to hit on?
Yes, because thankfully no one even referenced what might also be my favorite episode of the show. And I want to bring it up, and I want to talk about it because I think it is an episode that there's no one episode that crystallizes this show. It's too good. I mean, maybe it's all a dream. Maybe it's the closest to actually trying to do everything that the show does. But the Homeliest Little Horse does so many things well in a way that the show doesn't usually do them. Donald Glover never wrote himself a more sort of showy episode as an actor. And I don't mean that as an insult. Like I don't find it over the top showy. It is a showcase for him. And he is brilliant in it. It is a beautiful piece of acting all the way through, not just the stuff that's obviously, you know, is obviously showing off. the recognition at the end is so good. It is. I mean, anybody watching, anybody. Yeah, I think anybody knows what's coming. It's not a surprise ending by any means. But as a reminder, this late in the series, that no, Earn's not okay. I think it's a super strong piece of, you know, Bible for a season writing to bring this up again. And on top of that, I love it, and I'm gonna talk about this again in 3 weeks when we talk about Fleabag. I am a sucker for when a work of art, I don't want to say gives like a thesis statement. They don't have to come right out and say what this is or what it's about. But the moment in that show, in that episode, when Earn is in therapy and gets asked if he trusts anybody and says no, not completely.
Well, maybe Darren.
that was just man. It was like, yes, I am watching the show I thought I was watching. that's a giant tip of the hat to everybody that loves and gets the show. And
it is.
Really,
and you know,
I really loved that episode a lot.
You know, I always went back and forth on Al and Darius being my favorite characters. We talked a lot about them, but before we go, can I just say that Brian Tyree Henry, what he did with just a sigh. He said so much with just a sigh or a roll of his
eye roll.
Or the set of his shoulders. You know, I mean, and Zazie Beetz had a thankless role.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there are things in season 3 that made me really start to go, ooh, what the fuck are they doing here? And then in the final episode of season 3, you can tell she's disassociated. And I watched the episode, and I said, she's carrying around a baguette. And is that mold? Yes, that's a moldy baguette. She's carrying around a moldy baguette. She's going to hit somebody with
that.
That's
his omelette.
That thing's fucking rock hard like a baseball bat. She's going to murder somebody with it. She's going to break. Yeah, and now she's kneecapped somebody with a moldy baguette. But then any problems I might have had with her from season 3 vanished in work ethic, which really showed you why she wasn't had started to posit that maybe she wasn't a good mother. And she's actually a really good one.
Mm-hmm. She was a really good one going through a really hard time.
Yep. Which goes back to what Earn and Darius and Al had all said, you know, that, yeah, she actually was a good mother. But, yeah, I just thought that was worth bringing up because, you know, I talked about my problems with women on the show, that I think the show could have done more. Not that the material wasn't good, but I think they could have done more. And I do think that she deserves some credit here because we really haven't had a chance to talk that much about her. So I thought it was worth that. So, Aaron, anything that you want to bring up real quick before you get going?
Oh, man. This is a show that gave us Thick Judy. It gave us deep-fried human hand. It gave us a man with an alligator as a pet. It gave us Donald Glover in whiteface and fat suits. It gave the world Brian Tyree Henry and Lakeith Stanfield and Zazie Betts. What can I say about this show that we haven't already said? It's just amazing.
And maybe the strongest statement on white privilege ever, coming from the mouth of Liam Neeson when he said, no, when you're white, you don't have to learn to be better. Which is like, oh, shit, this show really does understand the root of the problem.
And they got somebody to say, like, that's, like, such a brave performance for Liam Neeson because they honed in on an actual controversy that he had, and they like, put it all out there. Like, and then they, like, twist it. Like, they gave the apology and then revealed that the apology was false, and then they revealed why the apology was false. And, like, the performance became the apology because, obviously, the apology wasn't real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that pretty much brings us to the end. And like I said, we could go on another half hour, another hour and a half. We could do 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of these shows. But I think we'll leave that for others to discuss. Once again, I want to thank the two of you for coming in and sharing this with me. I want to thank everybody out there for listening. You're appreciated. And please come back again next week. We have a good show coming up again, I hope. I hope you all enjoyed this one. It was a pleasure. And on the count of three, we will say goodnight. So, 1, 2, 3, good night.
Judy is sick.